Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, and welcome to another ebullient episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. On today's podcast, we have a wonderful phone interview with Jonathan Abarbanel, the theater critic I'm pretty sure you've heard of. Also, Chicago critic Tom Williams will be bringing us a couple of more audio reviews for your listening ears. And of course, as always, we have Chicago's theater news. So sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, leading you through Chicago's theater news for the week of April 17th, 2006. The Goodman Theater has announced its new Stage Door series, a very provocative mix of lectures, discussions, and special performances designed to give audiences a behind-the-scenes look at the Goodman Theater's productions. This season will have three events that are not to be missed. The Healing Power of Laughter will be on Monday, May 15th. The Legacy of Madam C.J. Walker will be on Monday, June 19th. And Latino Theater Around the World, Past, Present, and Future, will be on Monday, August 14th. Tickets for these not-to-be-missed events can be purchased at the Goodman Theater box office or by going online at www.goodmantheater.org. And remember, that's theater with an R-E. Steppenwolf Theater will be entering its second season of its First Look Repertory of New Works project. The First Look Repertory of New Work project is a chance for audience members to get behind the scenes of the developmental process of their productions. The three plays running in repertory at the Steppenwolf Garage will be 100 Saints You Should Know by Kate Fodor, Spare Change by Mia McCullough, and The Butcher of Baraboo by Marissa Wegrison. 101 lucky audience members who enroll in the First Look 101 series will have a stunning two-month look at the rehearsals and the actors discovering their characters right before their eyes. Now that's pretty cool. Timeline Theater, the company dedicated to producing plays both deeply entwined with history and connected to current social-political events, will be giving you a chance to be transported over four centuries with their 10th anniversary season. Their 2006-2007 season will include The General from America from Tony Award-winning playwright Richard Nelson, The Children's Hour, Lillian Hellman's landmark drama, Harmless by one of Chicago's most highly acclaimed playwrights, Brett Nephew, and Widower's Houses, the first play by George Bernard Shaw. Don't miss it. Stephen Sondheim and John Wideman's dark and provocative musical, Assassins, will be presented by the award-winning ensemble of Open Eye Productions at Chicago's Storefront Theater. Assassins will run from May 12th through June 18th, Thursdays through Saturdays. Don't miss it. Rumors are abound that the people producing Billy Elliot have scrapped their plans for a Toronto premiere. Looks like Chicago may be back on the bill for its pre-Broadway training ground. Stay tuned. And congratulations to Steppenwolf Ensemble member K. Todd Freeman. He has just joined the cast of Wicked. And that's the touring production, not the Chicago production. I repeat, that is the touring production, not the Chicago production. Congratulations, K. Todd Freeman. The newest Broadway musical by Alan Menken will be Leap of Faith. You may remember that Steve Martin film from about a decade back. Well, it is expected to hit Broadway for the 2007-2008 season, but has yet to choose a city for its Broadway training wheels. Come on, Chicago, let's make a leap of faith and get Leap of Faith here in Chicago. Well, thank you very much for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here's my review of Angels in America, Part 2, Perestroika, by Tony Kushner, directed by Sean Graney in a co-production between the Hypocrites Theater and Bailiwick Repertory Theater. Angels in America, Part 1 and Part 2, both won the Tony Awards for Best Play, and the work is considered by many to be a great achievement. It is Kushner's deeply complicated theatrical happening, full of ideas from gay themes to attacks on conservative ideology to a demonstration of the horror of AIDS to the deconstruction of the American myth of progress as it dramatizes moral responsibility during politically repressive times. Kushner is trying to shock us into awareness and as a call to action through his emotional drama that Sean Graney has marvelously mounted. Both parts of Angels in America are must-see for serious theater patrons. I'd try to see them on the same day or the next day to fully gather the power and scope of the American classic. This can happen because the show is done in repertory. You can see it on part one on one day and part two on the next day. And on the Saturdays, you can see both parts in one day, which is what I highly recommend if you really want to get the essence of this powerful show. Part 2, Perestroika. Perestroika has the same characters where we see Roy Cohen suffering from the horror of AIDS and receiving nursing from Belize, Pryor, and Lewis's friends. Joe Pitt has split from Harper and takes up with Lewis, whose guilt for abandoning Pryor almost destroys him. Hannah Pitt arrives from Iowa to set things right for the Mormon couple. She meets Pryor, who now has visions of the angels and becomes a prophet and spokesman for the coming message. Director Graney sprinkles humor with his impressive sound effects and stellar lighting to heighten the dramatic tension that explodes into a most compelling theatrical event. The cast seems more comfortable with the work that plays out in several strong performances. Scott Bradley's Pryor, Kurt Ehrman's Roy Cohen, and J.B. Waterman's Joe Pitt were particularly effective in Part 2. Add Steve Wilson's Lewis and Cliff London's Belize with fine work, and the amazing Michelle Moe continues her splendid take on the wacky Harper. And Part 2 sizzles with wrenching performances. Jennifer Grace as the Angel and Donna McGowan as Hannah and Ethel Rosenberg contribute timely work to the show. Angels in America, Perestroika is a dense, complicated work that isn't easy to follow at times, and it could overwhelm the faint of heart. It is a totally engrossing play, chock full of powerful themes presented in a highly stylized production that will stimulate thought, move you emotionally, and shake you up like few plays can. The journey will amaze you and ultimately leave you with the hope that reconciliation will make America a better place. Pryor's speech by the Bethesda Fountain in Central Park is uplifting and hopeful. Angels in America Part 1 and Part 2 is a major achievement for Sean Graney and the Hypocrites Theater Company. See both of these shows to experience the power of great theater. And let me add one little side note here, that Angels in America certainly is a play that can be hard to follow, because actually Tony Kushner wrote several plays in one. But it's kind of like some of the Shakespeare's that you see. You don't necessarily get everything that happened. You don't necessarily understand every plot line, but it's not necessary. Every time I've seen this play, and I have now seen it several times, I get new meanings from it and new understandings, and there's nuances and parts of it that I now think I get. And that's exactly the essence of powerful work. That's why we see them over and over again, and why they become classics. and I would definitely put Angels in America Part 1 and Part 2 in that category. I've also been asked the question of, can we see Part 2 without seeing Part 1? Yes, absolutely. It does make it a tad harder to follow, and maybe you'd have to read up a little bit and get some notes so you get a basic idea. But I think if you pay attention early, you'll see the plot lines and the connections from Part 1. But the way to really get the show is to see both parts. My rating on Angels in America Part 1 and Part 2 are not to be missed. It is at the Bailiwick Arts Center, which is located at 1229 West Belmont in Chicago. The schedule runs Thursdays 7:30, Fridays 7:30, Saturdays 2:30 and 7:30, Sundays at 2:30. Please call 773-883-1090 or go to either bailiwickrep.com or to thehypocrites.org to get more information, because it is in repertory. For example, I believe you can see Part 1 on Thursday and Part 2 on Friday. You can see Part 1 on Saturday and Part 2 on Saturday. You want to spend all day, which is recommended. But please check the schedule so you will be able to see. Part 2 runs 3 hours and 20 minutes. Part 1 runs around 3 hours and 10 minutes. So it's a full day of theater. The number for Angels in America, 773-883-1090. That's 773-883-1090. This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Here is my review of The Secret Garden, with book and lyrics by Marcia Norman, music by Lucy Simon, based on the novel by Frances Hodgson Bennett, directed by Walter Stearns, musical direction Eugene Dyson, produced by Porch Light Musical Theater at the Theater Building, Chicago. Secret Garden blossoms with rich vocals. Porchlight Music Theater has assembled another gem of a musical with their marvelously sung The Secret Garden. This highly emotional and thoroughly haunting musical is a three-hanky show. This splendid show equals Porchlight's acclaimed Sweeney Todd, produced a year or so ago, and once more demonstrates Walter Stearns' deft directing talent. He knows how to capture the atmosphere and the essence of a large-scale musical within the confines of a modest space and small budget. Often less is more, and the intimate Chicago Theater Building stage projects the warmth of the show directly into our hearts. The Secret Garden is a beautiful show, with wonderful English-style harmonies in an operatic tone. The atmosphere of gloom and sorrow is projected toward the mysterious powers of the garden of Yorkshire's manor. With an intriguing storyline and compelling characters, The Secret Garden is a warm-hearted, colorful show whose tone ranges from sad and haunting to charming and uplifting. Based on the novel by Frances Hodgson Bennett, The Secret Garden tells the story of Mary Lennox, played here by Mallory Basic, a lonely little girl who is sent to live with her Uncle Archibald, played by Michael Aaron Lindner, in Yorkshire after being orphaned by a cholera epidemic in India in 1906. Still grieving over the loss of her beloved wife Lily, who was played by Bethany Dawn Lindner, who died 10 years earlier during childbirth, and distraught over the conditions of his bedridden son, Archibald casts a dark shadow over the manor until Mary Lennox discovers a secret garden that once belonged to Lily. By nursing this garden back to life, Mary somehow restores life to her grieving uncle and his sick son, Colin, played by Drew Mayusha. The show features outstanding voices producing a haunting melodies that the score in almost operatic quality totally overwhelms us. Featuring many outstanding singers led by Michael Aaron Lindner, who landed a powerful A Bit of Earth, Marcia Norman's lyrics and terrific musical score by Lucy Simon is in excellent hands with this cast. The ensemble harmonies and stunning solos enrich Eugene Dyson's orchestrations. Luke Mills was charismatic and sparkled as Dickon. His rapport with Mallory Basic's Mary Lennox was magic. Basic and Drew Mayushka as Colin were precocious as the two children. The two instantly win our hearts as pure innocence. Jim Sherman's Ben, the gardener, and Angela Ingersoll's Martha, the maid, together with Nicholas Foster's Neville, added fine performances with each landing their numbers in clear voice. Bethany Dawn Lindner's golden voice sent chills with her haunting Come to My Garden. Her duet with Michael, How Could I Ever Know, brought tears to our eyes. Luke Mills and Mallory Basics' stirring Wick and Angela Ingersoll's Hold On were terrific show-stopping numbers. The Secret Garden is a mysteriously enchanting feel-good musical that will leave you teary-eyed and fulfilled. The journey to unlock the secrets of the past through flashbacks, dream sequences, with the aid of a strolling chorus of ghosts, gave The Secret Garden an enchantment rich in atmosphere and emotional tones that ultimately shows us that we must let go of the past and enjoy the possibilities of life and the future. Hope emerges supreme as Mary Lennox shows us the way. Take the family to see this masterpiece. This is a major musical show with downtown quality at storefront prices. Take the entire family to see this masterpiece. Porchlight Show is one of the best of the year. My rating on this show, not to be missed. It is at the Theater Building Chicago, 1225 West Belmont, the schedule for The Secret Garden, Fridays and Saturdays at 7:45, Sundays at 3 p.m. Starting Saturday, May 6th, there are 3 p.m. matinees. The running time is 2 hours and 25 minutes with intermission. It will run through May 28th. Call 773-327-5252. That's 773-327-5252. Let me just add, for a ticket price of $30, and I believe it's $28 for children, it is a much better buy than many of the downtown shows you'll see for $75 or $80. So don't miss The Secret Garden. This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Interview Podcast. Today's interview is with Jonathan Abarbanel, who is a longtime Chicago theater expert. Jonathan's background is he's a theater contributor for Chicago Public Radio, theater editor for the weekly Windy City Times, which is a newspaper. He's a correspondent and longtime columnist for Backstage, the national trade paper and website. He's also a senior writer for Perform, Inc., senior writer for the Chicago Footlights Monthly Program Magazine, Chicago's correspondent and critic for TheaterMania.com, theater site reporter for the National Endowment for the Arts. He's also a member of the Theater Critics Association. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm glad to be with you.
Wow, it's a pleasure to have a person. Let me just add this, Jonathan. I have to publicly thank you for 5 years ago when naively I was asked to be a reviewer for the now defunct Wicker Park Voice. One of the first people I contacted by doing a Google search was you, and you were running the Theater Critics Association convention, and you let me participate in that. I learned more that 1 week from 100 critics than I could have learned in a lifetime.
Well, that's what we like to call a pontificate of critics when we gather in conference like that.
That was amazing. And you were you were the guy to put that together. I mean, that had to be a heck of a lot of work.
Well, I had a good committee to work with. You know, the League of Chicago Theaters was my co-sponsor, and they provided a great deal of assistance. And other members of the American Theater Critics Association locally were also on the organizing committee, and, many hands made light work.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
How would you describe the state of the Chicago theater scene in the year 2006?
Well, I would say, unlike how I would describe the State of the Union, I would say that the state of Chicago theater is very excellent, very vibrant, and very much flourishing. It's continued to flourish now for over 30 years and doesn't seem to show any signs of weakening.
Well, I see how many people from New York are the actors and directors and playwrights are coming here to get their work done.
Yeah, indeed. A number of actors now for some years have given up the struggle in New York and resettled in Chicago because they're, you know, Tom, the reality of a professional actor is that at any given time, more are out of work than are at work. But the averages are better in Chicago than they are just about any place else in the country, and that's why people come here. And you know, the new paradigm is even among Broadway shows coming to Chicago is to start a Chicago company, not simply have a tour that comes through. But you now have Wicked and the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee that are here for a long, long time. And the cast includes some Chicago actors, but also some actors who used to be from New York. To be in the company of a production like this, you actually have to set up a residency in Chicago. It's one of the rules of the Actors Union.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. All right, let me ask you this. Let's get a little background on you. Tell us how you became a theater critic, what your background is.
You know, I often explain to people that it's not like being a doctor or a lawyer. There's no set training that that you must go through to be a theater critic. You don't have to go to journalism school. You don't even have to study theater, though it sure helps. You know, and there's no test you have to pass. If somebody hires you as a theater critic, why, you know, bang, you're a theater critic. In my own case, I was one of those kids who fell in love with theater someplace around the age of 8 or 10, and pursued theater whatever the opportunities were in high school. I studied theater at college. I went to Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts, and majored in theater and history. I had also been, the summer I was 17, I had been a member of theater Cherub, as we were called, which is the nickname for the National High School Institute at Northwestern University, and they had a theater division there. And one of my good friends and scene partners that summer when we were 17 was Barbara Gaines, who went on to found the Chicago Shakespeare. She and I acted opposite each other in the Turgenev play A Month in the Country. But I went on to study theater at Tufts University, and under Tufts auspices, I was able to live and study theater for a year, a full year, full academic year in London, and that was an incredible experience. And I had started writing. I never took a journalism course in my life, but I had started writing for the student paper, the school paper, when I was in high school. I continued to write for the school paper when I was at Tufts and was arts editor for 2 years. And that's where I really began reviewing, both for the Tufts newspaper and also for an independent small paper published in Cambridge, part of the Boston college scene.
Oh, okay.
And this was the time when a lot of the, you know, when shows on their way to Broadway still went on the road and tried out on the road, and Boston was one of the principal tryout towns. And there's so many colleges and universities in Boston, the student population was very, very important. And the student theater, the critics for the student newspapers, got the complimentary tickets just like real critics. So that's where I really cut my teeth in that experience.
How many years have you been reviewing?
Oh, Tom, let's see. Well, I don't have to tell you that I have gray hair, so...
well, this is a compliment.
Yeah, I've been reviewing here in Chicago for roughly 35 years.
Wow.
Actually, it might be a year or two beyond that.
So you must be the senior critic in town. I mean, now that Richard Christensen is retired.
Well, in fact, I am, and not a lot of people realize that because I'm not the critic for the Tribune or not the critic for the Sun-Times. Those, of course, are the most highly visible positions that a theater critic could have. But in terms of longevity and experience, yeah, I'm now the senior guy.
Wow.
I like to call myself sometimes, jokingly, the Claudia Cassidy of off-loop theater, the guy who's been around forever and was there at the creation, you know.
but you're, in fairness, though, you're not as mean as she was.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
From what I've read of hers, and I've archived her, boy, she could run a show out of town. They were scared to death of her, weren't they?
And she did more than once. And she ran conductors for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. She ran conductors out of town. She had it wasn't just that she was mean, because I knew her and she was perfectly charming in person. She her style as a writer was a devastating style, whether she was praising or criticizing. And her judgments were harsh, but usually sound. The difference is that, you know, the critic for a major newspaper had so much more space then. You know, she would regularly write, we're talking, Claudia Cassidy was writing in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and into the 1960s. And she regularly had 1,000 words to write a review of an opera or a concert at the symphony.
Wow, that's
or a work of theater.
You're lucky if you get 500 now, isn't it?
You're lucky, yes, lucky. And, you know, on weekends she wrote even more. You didn't have, at least when she started her career, you didn't have television. You know, when she started her career, you didn't even have talking movies. And so the live performing arts, whether it was music or theater, that was what there was. And they were far, far more important. Theater was regarded far more highly than it is today, at least in terms of the newspaper business and the amount of space devoted to it. Now you have films and records and CDs and, you know, all sorts of interactive stuff that is the new state of the art for entertainment. And theater, we love it, and it always renews itself, but it's an old art form.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one thing. I wanted to ask you what your philosophy of theater reviewing is, so then we can discuss some of the other, because there's, you know,
sure.
there's more than one philosophy, obviously.
Sure.
What is yours in general?
Well, I do have one, and I need to preface it. One thing we haven't talked about is that I haven't been just a critic. I've also been a practitioner, and I was an actor all through high school. I acted in college. I have acted professionally since then. I have worked from time to time in several different theater companies, the Goodman Theater and the Milwaukee Repertory Theater and the old St. Nicholas Theater Company, among them, as a literary manager, a dramaturg, the person who helps choose the repertory and helps develop new plays. So I've been on both sides of the footlights, and that very much has influenced my philosophy of reviewing. I don't believe that a critic should be nasty for the sake of being nasty. It is not my job to score points, off the backs of playwrights or directors or producers or actors. I feel that most shows that I see are neither black nor white. Like life itself, almost everything is some shade of gray. Hopefully it's a bright gray rather than a dark, dull gray.
Okay.
But most things are a mixed bag. And it's my job as a critic to point out both the good, the favorable, and what is not working so well. Hopefully my practical experience has given me some insight if something isn't working well. Hopefully I have some insight where I can make suggestions and be able to pinpoint why it's not working particularly well, rather than just saying it's bad or forget about it. I also don't think that it's my job to tell people, you must see this show or you must stay away. I try to write an educated opinion through which people can figure out what I think about the show. So I try to say something intelligent about the script itself, and on that basis, I hope people can make up their own minds.
So that you are not an advocate of ratings on shows?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, when Hedy Weiss was the critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, when she was on sabbatical in the late 90s, I was one of three critics that were brought on in a rotation to replace her for about 18 months on a freelance basis. And I find myself writing, usually two or three reviews a week for the Chicago Sun-Times. And we had to place a rating on them, you know, not recommended, somewhat recommended, recommended, highly recommended. And I just hated doing that. I have colleagues across the country who have to assign stars, 1 to 5 stars, and they hate doing it. And I have a colleague for one paper, a major daily paper in another city, and they actually have a little icon of a theater goer who's either sitting on his hands or applauding weakly or standing and applauding with wild enthusiasm. And he hates doing that.
But that's pretty hokey.
He has to decide which of those icons gets slapped on the review. Well, you know, they'll know if they read you.
Yeah, I agree.
I'll tell you something. You know, I figure that the people who read theater reviews They're reading them because they want to, because they're interested in theater. You know, people don't stop and read the theater reviews on a casual basis. The guy that turns to the sports page first, you know, is not going to stop along the way at the theater reviews. I mean, of course, this is not absolute. There are people who love sports and theater, too. But generally speaking, I feel I am writing reviews for people who know something about theater and have an interest in theater. And I figure we'll have read a number of my reviews, and over the course of time, they'll get some sense of my philosophy about theater and about politics and, you know, all the subject matter that theater deals with, too. We all bring our own philosophies and life experiences and prejudices and baggage to.
Well, begs the question of how much do you believe in personalizing? Because I'm not afraid to say, start out a review by saying, you know, I just saw Rent and everyone knows I don't like rock musicals. And then from, you know, let my bias be known up front.
Absolutely. You have to do that. You know, I'm from an old school of journalism where you weren't supposed to use the first person. You weren't supposed to say, I thought this and I thought that. I mean, nonetheless, the personal pronoun occasionally does sneak in, but you are absolutely right. You must make your prejudices known. And people who have read my stuff over a period of years are going to know that I am politically fairly liberal, that I generally don't make severe judgments. I try to interpret rather than judge, and there is a difference between those things.
Yes, there is.
And, you know, maybe the person who reads my reviews all the time knows that if I hated a show, that he or she will love it. And if I love a show, that he or she will hate it. You know, sometimes it doesn't matter as long as they can find some consistency to how I approach theater and my own opinions.
Well, I know when I read your reviews, I don't always agree with you, and that's what makes the world go round. But
yeah,
what I am so amazed about you is you come up with things, and I go, darn, I missed that. He's absolutely right. As soon as you talked about it, I said, how did I miss that? The fact that the way you do analyze the shows and put them in a larger context, I think really makes sense.
Thank you. We talked about the number of words, and people don't realize how important that is. You know, you take the papers today, at the Windy City Times, for which I'm theater editor, but also one of the critics, we generally run 5 or 6 reviews a week. And each of those reviews is up to 450 words long. It doesn't sound like much, and it isn't really, but compared to the 1,000 or 1,200 words that Claudia Cassidy used to get. But it's far more. You're right. You know, the Sun-Times, Hedy Weiss doesn't get 450 words every time she writes a review. You know, newspapers have made articles shorter and shorter and shorter, cut back and back and back. You look at the Reader each week, and they do a lead review that's long, maybe about 1,000 words, but just one. And then all their other reviews in their theater pages are like 150 words each.
Yeah, and that's sad to have a major production and try and analyze it in 150 words. Yeah.
How could you even talk about Hamlet intelligently in 150 words? And everybody knows Hamlet, let alone a world premiere that nobody knows.
Yeah.
You know, you spend 150 words just trying to put the literary product, if people don't know it, put the literary product in some sort of context.
Yes.
So that's the,
all right, let me ask you this. You've sort of answered it, but this question has to be asked. Do you consider yourself more of a consumer reviewer, like analyzing a play and letting people know whether or not they should see it directly or indirectly? Or are you more of a analytical critic or critiquing of the plays? Which school would you fall into more, do you think?
Well, I don't know whether it's true, but I probably would fall more into the second school. But it's, you know, it's what I said before. First of all, when I write for the Windy City Times, which is a general readership, I'm assuming that the people who turn to the theater reviews know something about theater. They're turning to those pages to see what's on now, what is open that week. So I'm assuming they have a certain knowledgeability, and I don't have to teach them everything every step of the way. At the same time, when I write a review for Backstage, which is a professional publication viewed by people in the trade, I can use more theater jargon. I can go to the point talking about details of the structure of a play more than I might for a for a general audience. So I kind of have a foot in both camps.
Well, that's great. I wish I did. I try and take the approach for the general audience that they're coming to my site because they want to go to a play and they're not sure what they want to see what's current. So I try and talk a little bit more of the basics. But I wish I had the opportunity to do that because that would be fun. Of course, I don't know if I'm qualified as you are because I'll tell you, folks, if you want to read a person that really knows this theater, anything with Jonathan of Arbonnel's name on it is worth reading. And I mean that. I read your stuff all the time, and it's really amazing. And even, it's half the time you convert me, even if I don't agree with you. That's scary.
I have to digress. For many years, the theater critic for the Chicago Sun-Times was Glenna Seiss. She was the predecessor to Hedy Weiss. And Glenna probably was the theater critic for the Sun-Times for 30 years or 35 years or so. And she used to use words a lot like, if she liked something, it was bright and brassy and full of pizzazz. And when we used to make fun of Claudia, to Glenna Seiss, we would say, well, she's bright and brassy and full of pizzazz. And I would read her reviews, and I'd get to the end of the review, and I would agree with her conclusions, but I would disagree with every step she took to reach that conclusion. And I said, I don't know how she does it. She comes out at the right place, but she gets there by, the wrong method. But I don't know whether she was persuading me or not, but that's just a digression from your comment.
Well, that begs the comment, who are the reviewers who influence you the most?
Well, let's see. Critics who have influenced me, because I started reviewing myself at a very young age, at the age of 19 or so, at college, I was already writing reviews. And I suppose the first people who influenced me were some of the other college paper reviewers, because you're at that age where one, you're impressionable, and two, you're trying to make an impression on other people.
Mm-hmm,
so
sure.
You might tend to be a little more falsely stylish or even smartass than you would normally be. The reviewers, I don't remember who the name of the reviewer, but when I was in school in Boston, there was the critic for the Christian Science Monitor. It was probably about the best around. As I have progressed, there have been critics such as Michael Feingold, the longtime senior theater critic for the Village Voice in New York, whose work I have admired. John Lahr, who's currently the critic for the New Yorker.
Yes, I've read his
stuff. Brilliant
writer.
Yes. And one of his predecessors, a woman for many years at the New Yorker, the late Edith Oliver, was an astute and caring theater critic. And even Claudia Cassidy, since I'm old enough to have been around when she was still reviewing, both in the Tribune and then after she retired from the Tribune, she did weekly radio reviews on WFMT. And just to listen to the way she put words together and the depth of knowledge that she had was really quite astounding.
Wow, that's very interesting. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this: what advice would you give to a young person who wanted to become a critic?
I would say there are several things you need to study. You don't necessarily need to study journalism. If you in some other way study writing, you learn to read and to speak proper, concise English and grammatical English. Obviously, you need to study theater, but I also would urge anyone who wants to be a theater critic, anyone who wants to go in theater, period, you need to also give yourself a broad and as deep as possible general education. You need to know about history. You need to know about the fine and applied arts, whether it has to do with architecture, or fashion, costume, dress, because theater always has been a mirror of its time, and you better know the political and social history, broadly speaking, of various nations and cultures and eras, or you won't understand the context in which the great classics were written, or even the context in which contemporary plays are written if you don't have some ability to analyze the world the way it is today.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. That helped me having a history political science degree.
Yeah, absolutely.
And being older when I got in it. And, of course, it doesn't hurt to go see a lot of theater, too, even if you're not reviewing, right?
Yeah, I'm assuming that.
Yeah,
I'm assuming
okay.
You'll go see a lot of theater, listen to a lot of music. You need to know about, the visual arts, music, it all cross-references. And if you know something about sports and science, all the better, Though those are some of my weaker areas personally. But the more you know, the better. Don't just study these things in terms of theater. Do it. You need to give yourself the experience. Try to be an actor, even if you're bad. Act in some shows. Try to direct something. Try to understand what the problems are. Hang some lights. Try to focus a light. Build a set, sew a costume, do as much of the practicum of theater as you can. Don't just be a theoretical.
That's great advice. Yeah, I agree with you. But that I'm glad you pointed that out, because how about having the passion for it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're crazy. I know. I go just about every night. You told me you used to do that, right?
I used to, and now I decided I wanted a life. I want to have dinner every now and then, or go to a movie, or get together with friends. So, now I'm in a position pretty much to pick and choose what I want to see. I see more than the minimum I need to, but I still have cut my theater going down to probably about four nights a week or so.
So that's still a couple hundred.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there are stretches of time when it's five or six or even seven nights a week. Seven in a row has become pretty rare for me in the last several years. But five or six happens a lot.
How do you stay fresh?
Tom, I don't know if I am fresh. I confront all the time. I have to ask myself, am I getting jaded or tired? I don't know. Probably someone other than me would be better to say that or not.
Well, I can tell you from what I'm reading of yours, it's not there. And there are some folks in town who, the bitterness kind of shows up. But it isn't shown in your writing.
Well, thank you.
I'm saying that sincerely,
part of it, I said I can pick and choose. I don't have to go see Nonsense again for the sixth time or the eighth time or anything for that matter. I mean, there are some shows I do want to see over and over again. The Tempest by Shakespeare or the Cherry Orchard by Chekhov. But I don't have to really see anything that I don't choose to see.
Oh, that's good.
That's a good position. And in Chicago, we have so much. Yeah, somebody does Nonsense, but that doesn't mean either I have to review it, and it doesn't mean that I have to send someone else from my paper to review it. There are probably 12 shows opening in any given week, and we can only run five or six reviews. And I probably am not going to, send someone to see yet another production of Nonsense.
That's good. That's...
I hate to single that one out. It's a very enjoyable, entertaining show. There's an audience for it, but this is a city built on new work and innovation.
Absolutely.
And that's where I try to put my attention. And, part of it, I don't have to tell you this. You walk into the most unlikely spot, a little 40-seat, overheated or undercooled storefront someplace, a company you've never heard of, and they astonish you with something.
Isn't that fun? That's what makes the job fun.
That's it. John Lahr wrote a famous book a dozen years or so ago, collected essays and reviews on theater, and the title was Astonish Me! ! And that's why we keep going.
Yeah.
And it still happens, and I guess I'll stay fresh as long as there's still something out there that can astonish me.
Well, that's great. I got to get this question in, because I know you'll have a good answer. If you could interview anyone, dead or alive, who would that in theater, playwright, actor, whatever, who would that be and what would you ask them?
Well, I know who it would be. I mean, absolutely, without thinking twice, William Shakespeare.
Oh, I knew you'd say that.
The guy I want to sit down with. I don't know who wouldn't say William Shakespeare.
Okay. And what would you ask him?
I would not ask him, hey, Bill, did you really write your own plays? Because I think he did. You know what? I don't have a... really a clue. I would be in awe. I just think it's clear from his plays that he had really this tremendous polymath mind. He had an interest in so many different subjects. He had he was thoughtfully, and he had a brilliant sense of humor. And you know, the hell with interviewing him. I just say, hey, Bill, let me buy you a drink. Let's sit and chew the fat.
Boy, would that sounds great. That's a great place to end this thing, because we've just about run out of time. Jonathan Abarbanel, it has been great. You are one of the people that I respect the most in theater in Chicago. That's why I wanted you to be the original person for our segment of profiles of other theater critics that we are going to do on Talk Theater in Chicago.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. I hope that this works well and that we've set the bar high enough.
Well, that's and I mentioned that to a couple of your colleagues that you were coming on first, and they go, oh, geez, I'll have to listen to that over. Yeah, set the bar high. That's cool. That's what we're trying to do.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much. And folks, you have listened to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. We'll see you next time.
Well, thank you very much for listening to our Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. But before I let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote is from Richard II, Act 1, Scene 3. This must my comfort be, that sun that warms you here shall shine on me. And thank you again for listening to us. Remember, we have a new podcast on our servers every Monday ready for your ears. Until then, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.